We are very pleased to talk to you today, both from a personal point of view of seeing people face to face for the first time in 2 years, but secondly to talk about the great results that we had in 2021. I'm not going to go through the results. I think you saw the press release and we had the presentation this morning. A strong growth in all three businesses in 2021. A lot of new launches, many business development deals. Challenging environment still in the U.S., but overall, I think the performance was really, really good in all three businesses, and the strong guidance for 2022. So with that, I was just going to open it up for question and answer. Maybe we start in the room here, and then, of course, we go online a little bit later on when we are running out of questions in the room. So who wants to start? Yeah.
Just 1 second. If you are asking questions in the room, you could use the microphone. They don't need to bring on Susan. And if you could introduce yourself to people on the line.
Emily Field from Barclays. Maybe just to start, the deflationary environment in generics, I believe you're talking about low double-digit inflation for 2022. So the factors driving that, if you expect that to persist, or kind of what you think is a more normalized environment for generic price deflation.
Yeah, so what we saw in 2021, we saw a gradual worsening of the pricing environment. And you see that on the slides we put up this morning, that 2020 was particularly good year in a way. We had the price erosion of around 4% for the generics business in 2020. We guided 6 to 8% or mid to high single digit last year pricing, and our pricing came out just about 8% for the full year in 2021, maybe 8.5%, so just about 8%. But we saw that throughout the year that there had been the focus of the customers had been the security of supply in 2020. So there were very few tenders or auctions happening in 2020. So I sometimes say there was like a pent-up demand from the customers of tendering out the portfolio. So we got so many tenders coming in the first half that impacted then the second half in terms of pricing. So that's how it started. I think also maybe some of our peers had inventory issues, because there were less volume in the market during COVID due to less diagnosis. We are back to normal volume in the market, as we showed in our slide. So we have the feeling that at least some of our peers have the inventory issues and therefore pushed down the price a little bit in the market. In terms of how long will this last, you never know, but I believe, and I've been doing this now for just over 20 years, the pricing in the U.S. is cyclical. It really is cyclical, and I've been very close to the market in the U.S. since 2010, and you can see that you usually have maximum 2 challenging years, and then you usually have 3 to 4 very decent years. We had 16 and 17, which was challenging years from pricing. We had 18, 19, and 20 quite good years. We had the chains of the storm a little bit in 21, and we are forecasting a low double-digit pricing for 22 based on the tenders that we see and the expectation in the market. So I'm still optimistic on the market. This is cyclical, and I'm hoping also, like, if there's any extra inventory of our competitors, that will flush through, hopefully, in the first half of the year. So I'm optimistic about the market, but clearly we are in a little bit different environment today than 24 months ago, for example. Somebody has to go
more. Pete Vidal, Citi. 3 questions. Remind myself. Pandas. Teva talking about pandas, change in FDA regulations where drugs that are approved pre-84 and are being converted to a sort of 505B2. So that could have implications for generic companies in terms of post-marketing surveillance or potential litigation. So I think they're saying they might have to withdraw at least 30 products potentially from the market, and some of them are on the shortage list. And I think there are two that stand out for Hikma, dexamethasone and digoxin. So just wondered if that is on your radar or not. And then specifically to Hikma, on the generics outlook, I mean, the margin is pretty impressive. You always said 20% is good, and you're guiding to 25 or 20, let's say 24 to 25. Is that all just product mix, or some cynics are saying it's just because you're not spending as much? Just wanted to get a sense there, because it does feel that you're finally conceding that the revenue outlook for things like Advair and Vascepa might not be as big as people hoped. And then lastly, on the buyback, I mean, in the past you said, look, it's a bit like giving a kid a candy to a kid. You know, it's a short-term impact. What is the signaling or thought behind doing the buyback now? Is it just to help prop up the earnings outlook, or how should we interpret that that buyback? Thank you.
Do you want to start on the buyback, Sammy?
Yeah, I'll start on the buyback. I think in terms of our capital allocation priorities since the Capital Market Day in 2018, we have four priorities. One is investing in organic growth, M&A, BD, acquisition. And this has not changed. Today, our balance sheet is very strong. We have a very low leverage, even within our industry. We have the flexibility. So a buyback of up to 300 million is not going to affect our ability to pursue further acquisition. And you saw during this year, we had a couple of, like, signed some licensing deal, acquired a few products. We did Custopharm. So it's not going to have an impact on our financial flexibility. So it's in a way that the board and the management, we believe that the market is not reflecting the intrinsic value of the company, and therefore maybe a share buyback just shows that we believe in the prospects of the company and the future.
And starting to meet, how quickly is it going to start?
It's gonna. We are going to do it over before the end of this year, so it's gonna spread during this year.
And on the older ANDAs approved prior to 1984, as you said, Pete, in your question, it's only affecting two products for us, which are relatively small. I think also to keep in mind is I don't think the FDA wants us to take these products off the market, because there will be a shortage on the market, especially on these two products that we have. Digoxin is a life-saving drug, but I think most of the applications are very old in the market, and it would be very bad for the market. And the second thing on dexamethasone, it's very important, especially now during COVID, but it's a relatively small product outside of COVID season. So I we keep an eye on it. I'm not sure it will be as drastic as Teva is painting it, but, out of the 85, 86 products we have in generics, it's only two of them that we are monitoring at the moment. And for digoxin, I doubt if it will come through. We are ready for it, but Texas.
I don't think that product. I don't think it's
No. So the question is basically if the bio study is older. But we need to check. But I don't think digoxin is at risk. Dexamethasone might be at risk, but we need to look into that. In terms of the generic margin, so remember when I joined 4 years and 4 days ago, the company, I basically set out my ultimate goal in 5 years' time would be to have a gross margin in the mid-40s and the net operating profit in the 20s. We have achieved that. Even in a year where we are guiding to double-digit price erosion, similar to what we saw in 2017, we are guiding to net operating profit 24 to 25%. And that highlights to you what we have done to this business. This is not the same business. If I remind you of the numbers in 2017, our net operating profit was 3.6% and our gross margin was 36%. So now we are guiding 24 to 25% net operating profit in a similar pricing environment as we are focusing. So totally different business. In terms of investment, we are continuing with the investment. So it's not we are getting to this level by cutting the R&D or cutting the sales. We are launching big specialty products. We hope we will bring Ryaltris to the market sometime around middle of this year. We have the approval in hand. but the supply is not available yet from Glenmark. Glenmark is responsible for the supply for us. So our best estimation is probably soon in third quarter that we'll be ready. So we will miss the main allergy season. But we need to start to build up sales force. We are expanding our promotion of Kloxxado. So really, it's not cost-cutting. It's control of the cost, of course. I think you saw that the gross margin for the generics in 2021 has never been higher. We showed 47% gross margin. And show me any peers that don't have injectables with like-to-like comparison. This is really amazing results. And it's about the work the team has done over the last 4 years. So I feel, you know, I have never committed to say it's going to be in the mid-20s, but I think this business, even in tough years like this, this business should continue to deliver a net operating profit in the 20s. I'm very confident about that.
Thibaut Boutrin, Morgan Stanley. So my first question on generic Xyrem. So I think it's included in the guidance is the launch in the middle of the year. Just if you could give us a little bit color on what you're expecting in terms of market share uptake, timing of competition launch, and I guess the kind of mid to long term outlook for this generic in terms of does it have a longer tail value than usual generics or not?
Yeah.
Just also on Kloxxado, if you could maybe give us a little bit of color on the early trends in the launch, what is different compared to what you were expecting before launch and the strategy you explained to us in the past months and quarters. And maybe just to finish on the biosimilars, so some of the biosimilar agreements you've made have only trials ongoing in China. And just if you could tell us more about your confidence of obtaining FDA approval with these trials when we saw what recently happened with Eli Lilly and an Innovent drug recently, where the FDA obviously doesn't seem to be ready to approve at least branded biologics based on a study conducted exclusively in China.
Yeah. So let me start on your last question around the biosimilar. So last year we signed two biosimilar deals with Biothera on ustekinumab and with Gedeon Richter on denosumab. Both really good companies, very impressive development. In terms of Gedeon Richter, they're doing a global trial. I'm not even sure they have a site in China. In terms of Biothera, they have patients in China, but they're running their trial in 6 different countries. So it will not be solely based on Chinese population, the phase 3 study, for sure. Overall, we read the guidance from the FDA, and this issue came up around the Eli Lilly analysis of their innovative product. I don't think it affects the biosimilars per se, but no matter what, we are running a global trial for both products. So we don't think that will be an issue for neither development. But, you know, you keep an eye on it. But I think it's a specialty product issue. But, you know, I'm more confident, of course, by having a global trial behind the development work for these. Your first question, if you could just repeat it. Let me take the Kloxxado while you're looking the other one up.
Xyrem.
Yeah, let me do Xyrem. So Xyrem, we have no guarantee when it's launched. We are saying around mid-year. It could be a little bit into the second half of the year, of course. But our best estimation is around mid-year. So it's difficult to give the exact timing. Xyrem or sodium oxybate is a specialty product in a closed system. So we have seen that the branded companies tend to retain a significant market share when you come into the market, and the best example is Advair today. I think GSK in fourth quarter was 52% market share. So our expectation is that the brand will maintain some market share due to the closed system and so few payers around this product. Because if only one payer decides to stay with Jazz, that could mean 60% of the patients. So this is a very different situation. When you're modeling it, you need to think about that. We obviously don't know, and we will know it when we launch the product. But that is what we have seen as an action. We're keeping an eye on it. But remember that we included in the guidance, but the timing of the launch is difficult to say because that is based on the decline of Xyrem. So I'm not going to help you to model this in too much details, but you have to recognize that if an acceleration takes place, the volume has declined quite significantly. On top of that, that the brand might keep some of the market. But we are ready to go. The good thing is this is an authorized generic, so we will get the supply from Jazz whenever this is reached, this level. And we also have access to the REMS program. So we are ready to move whenever the calculation tells us that we can have an accelerated approval. We feel it's going to be, as I said, around mid-year, but we haven't even seen the sales numbers in January yet. So it's monitoring how the sale is going, because it's not like you can pick up a Xyrem in IQVIA, as I'm sure you know. In terms of Kloxxado, we are very pleased with the feedback on Kloxxado. So we are working now in twofold with the communities, where we are going to different states in the U.S. and buying into their police departments and get it on their register. We have had a good feedback because the feedback, especially from the emergency workers and police departments, they like to have a higher dose instead of having to give two doses of 4 milligrams, because that is two things they have to have on their belt. But there is a tender cycle in the state, so it takes a little bit of time. Remember, we only launched this at the end of August of last year, but we are really pleased with that. On the prescription thing, they have started to come. You can see that there is slowly every week, there's more and more, there's a growth in the prescription, still relatively low. But we also got one of the major pharmacy chains in the U.S. to keep it in stock as an emergency medicine in their pharmacies. So that is a big win for us. So it takes time, but it's as per expectation or a little bit better. It is a good thing. Maybe the follow-up question, has the generic version of Narcan impacted our sales? It really hasn't, because the generics solely focus on the prescription market. Generics wouldn't go into the communities. You need a totally different sales force, and it's costly. So the impact of the generic 4 milligram, which Teva introduced to the market, and the AT, really hasn't impacted our sale as we expected.
Hi, Christian Glennie from Stifel. Just to follow up then, I guess, on a couple of products, we're expected to step up last year or at some point, generic Advair, generic Vascepa. We've seen generic Advair around 8%, Vascepa 12-14, I think. What is the expectation then? I mean, have you got supply sorted on Vascepa? What's the expectation for both products as it relates, obviously, to your guidance for the generics overall?
So if I take both products, so in terms of icosapent, the challenge here is we got a third player in the market that's now actively marketing at the moment. So Apotex introduced by the end of last year as a new entrance to the market. We don't know if Teva is coming or not. They have approval in hand, but they haven't launched the product. So at the same time, there's still a shortage of supply in the market. If you look at IQVIA for fourth quarter, you still see that Amarin remains about 80%. Apotex is still at zero because they just launched by the end of December, so they don't register yet, but they are active in the market in early this year. I think we came at 14% and Dr. Reddy's at 6%. So you can still see that there is a shortage everywhere in the market. We are working everywhere to increase our supply. I think for the time being, we expect increase a little bit through the year, but the step up in increase would mean, to our expectation, would mean a big step up, would mean that the FDA has to inspect some sites, both for us and maybe for the others. So that's the reason, because the queue at the FDA to get a quality inspection for foreign plants is very long at the moment, and this is not a priority. So there could be some time until you see a big step up in the generics with a significant API supply in the market. So three-player market, it's quite competitive, but only at around 20% of last year, probably a little bit more now in terms of business. In terms of generic Advair, the Teva got approval in December. They haven't launched yet, but I read the analyst notes as you did about them, so they are expecting to launch soon, whatever soon soon means. In the market, obviously, Mylan and Prasco. In terms of others that could come in to keep an eye on, I think Lannett, in their press release on their second quarter earnings, they said they're expecting a letter from the FDA in February, and there's not many days left of February, so let's see what the letter says. And then Cipla has indicated that they're waiting for a feedback on their deficiency responses from the FDA. So it is, there are more companies thinking around it. In terms of our market share, so we, I think in fourth quarter on average, we had about 20% of the generic market. So 10% of the total market, if you count it like that, or, you know, roughly. I think you will see still an increase because it's been a gradual increase to that. We have plenty of supply. We don't have any shortage of supply. We have manufacturing lines. We probably could supply nearly the whole market if it would be needed. But overall, it is going to be more, significantly more competitive product in 2022 than it was in 2021.
I
don't guide on revenue on individual products. It depends also on when Teva comes and if Cipla comes or anyone else. But, you know, so there's so many things outside of our control that can affect it.
Hi, Siggy. It's Paul Cutton from Numis. Just pivoting to the injectables business, I'm just wondering if you could provide a bit of a overview of the pricing environment kind of around the world within injectables. The margins taking a bit of a step down next year, to what extent is that sort of a cautious assumption reflecting maybe the contract manufacturing, and where might that lead in the next few years? And then just generally on your customer service proposition, closeness to the hospitals, I mean, is anybody starting to kind of match that to your levels?
Yeah, so good question. So overall, the injectable business did extremely well in 21. And the reason I say that is that the comparator in 2020 is very tough, because we were selling, especially in the first half of 2020, so much of the COVID-related treatment. So the comparison, remember, mid-year, we were not growing in the U.S., and on full-year basis, our U.S. business grew 4%. Which is very significant because we had a strong comparator in 2020. In terms of our U.S. business, we've been doing very well. We launched 15 products in 2021. We continued to gain market share, so we became number two in the market. We overtook Fresenius in terms of volume in the U.S. market. So Pfizer is still the biggest, but we became number two. In terms of our service level, they are really second to none. We've been really, really good in dealing with that. In terms of the margin, so I think 21 we did 37.6 net operating profit, which is a really strong profit. You have to always keep in mind that US has the highest profit, and MENA and Europe have a lower profit. and both MENA and Europe are growing faster than the US. So there will be a little bit dilution always on the net operating profit. There's more dollars at the end of the day, but the faster I grow in Europe and MENA versus the US market, there will be a little bit of dilution in the business. In terms of 22, we are excited about that in terms of the new launches. We expect to be in the similar numbers as previously, 10 to 15 new launches for the US injectables. The growth in Europe will continue. We expect to have our first revenues in France. And with the small acquisition we did in Canada of Teledent Canada, bankruptcy of the assets of Teledent Canada, gave us a little bit of platform to launch our own products. We have registered 9 products already in Canada, but we have not launched it because if you launch only with 9 products, you are loss-making. So we wanted to sit on our hands until we have a big enough portfolio to offer. In MENA, we will continue on the biosimilars, getting more approval, and that will really drive the growth of injectables in MENA in 22, especially on Herzuma and Rituximab. You know, we are getting the approvals through in more and more countries every year, and still Remsima is performing very well. So in terms of the profit, I've always maintained that you should think about the injectables 35 as the base. We always hope to do a little bit better than that. You know, shortages in the market usually mean you do a little bit better. You can't build in shortages into your forecast. You know, that would be, you know, because, for example, Fresenius, even though they have challenges after Melrose Park plant, it really hasn't benefited anyone because they have done a good job in managing that quite well. So overall, very excited about the injectables. We have the first sale of our compounding. So compounding, we kicked that off. We have now a manufacturing plant that is fully running with validated processes. The challenges are that you need to license in every state in the U.S. So we are just starting. So we are between 5 and 10 states at the moment. So we expect that will come through the year. Some of the states require us to have the FDA to visit before. So then we need to wait for the FDA to visit. So this is why in 22, don't expect a big contribution from this. This will be the start year. And hopefully mid-year, my thinking is I can give you more of a forecast of long-term what this business can do. We will see more of the market. We will have better information from the hospitals. But this is the kickoff that we see in 22.
Just adding to that, back to the margin, in 2021, there was some impact in the injectable margin coming from Epic. So if you exclude that, and there's an appendix, some explanation about the hyperinflationary impact which affected the injectable board, the margin would be higher, like 38.9% in constant currency. So slightly higher than 2020 as well.
So just a matter
of price, price, we focus a lot on generic price deflation and things like that. So and a lot of investors will ask me, well, what's it like for injectables, Paul? And,
So we are still remaining that it's low to mid-single digit. We are not seeing the pricing impact there because I've always said and maintained that the service level that we have and the relationship and how we have been able to step into when others have not been able to deliver has a little bit helped us to maintain pricing better on the injectable side than on the non-injectable side, on the US generic. So I'm much more positive on the injectable pricing environment in the U.S. than maybe on the non-injectables.
Thank you.
Yeah, so operator, if you open the line for questions online.
Sure, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star followed by one on your telephone keypad now. If you change your mind, please press star followed by 2 to withdraw your question. If you're streaming via web browser, kindly press the flat icon on your web browser to ask a question. When preparing to ask your question, please ensure your phone is unmuted locally. We now have a first question from Matt Herman from Stisville. Please go ahead.
Great. Thanks very much for taking my question. It was just really a follow-up on the injectables, again, on the pricing, just because we've seen this week from Fresenius commentary about, tougher pricing environment in their injectables business. And I know you said your customer relationships mean you don't expect a change from your previous guidance. I just wanted to try and understand, are their relationships not as strong, or what is the difference? Are they seeing a change in the market? So I just wanted to understand why you're not seeing that change.
Yeah, the issue is between Fresenius and Hikma, the key difference is the portfolio that we have. So our portfolio, we have over 120 products, but all of our products are relatively small. When we get a competition on a single molecule, that doesn't affect us nearly as much as when Fresenius has at least 5 very, very big products in the hundreds of millions in revenue. So when they get a competition or new entrants on these bigger molecules, they obviously have reflected in more price erosion that you see in the market. So the build-up of the portfolio, I think Fresenius has a really good relationship with the customers. I don't think there's a big difference there, but it's really the build-up of the portfolio why we are reporting a little bit different numbers of how we see the pricing in the market, where for us, having a very large portfolio but really no blockbusters to talk about in, I would love to have their blockbusters, but also at the same time in a tough pricing environment, it is better to have smaller products and a lot of them.
Okay. And then just last question was just on Custopharm. Can you update us in terms of the completion and what the process is at the moment in terms of the regulatory review, or FTC review?
So, by the way, Custopharm is not included in the injectable guidance. Obviously, we don't know the exact numbers today, and we don't know exactly when we close, so it wouldn't be right to try to guide for those numbers. In terms of when this transaction closed, it's at the same time as we said when we announced, so we expect it by mid-year, or hopefully in the second quarter of this year. We are working closely with the FTC. Nothing is quick in this process, but really there's no outstanding issue. We are very comfortable on the transaction itself, and we expect that to happen in second quarter.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Pete?
Thank you. We now have our next question from James Van Tempest from Jefferies. Please proceed with your questions.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my questions. Just starting with injectables, apologies if I missed it, but can you give us a little bit of clarity around the 35 to 37% margin? Is this based on regional mix, or is it more based on new launches? Just to give us a flavor of that. I'm just looking at 21, and I guess despite, Europe and MENA growing really, really well, which we know are low margin, you're still in the middle of your guidance. So, is the underlying, US margins going up, just given the growth that it's delivered and where you came in at the full year? And then the second question is just on Custopharm. I appreciate it's still to close, you're not guiding specifically, but just as a scenario to help us, if it was to close, say, at the middle of the year, can you give us a sense in terms of what, the contribution would be to the business? Thank you.
So on the margin itself, it is overall, it's still a strong margin. In terms of the 35 to 37, it has to do with the regional mix. A little bit, differentiation. There is an increase in the cost of transportation. there's a little bit of increase in cost of manufacturing that we're dealing with in this business, because you have to remember for the U.S., half the volume that we sell in the U.S. is coming from Portugal. So there is a tiny bit of increase in that cost that you really cannot push back to the customers. It's nowhere near that some of our peers are seeing, because we have a good control, but that's part of it. Part of it is that the biosimilars in MENA are growing the fastest, and biosimilars, because we are sharing the profit with Celltrion, naturally has a lower profitability. And then part of that is also, you know, how the contract manufacturing comes in overall. But overall, there's no big change in the business that means that the profitability is going way down. It's small things here and there, the regional, a little bit of increase in transportation costs, and then more sale of the partnership drugs, which means naturally impacting our operating profit. Second question, if you remember.
It's about Custopharm.
Custopharm, yes. So Custopharm, so the FTC doesn't allow me even to visit them. So I really don't know what their budget is for 2022. So that's why I'm very blindsided. Remember when we announced the transaction, we said that a rough estimate of the revenue for full year 2021 was 80 million. And that's really all I have. I have no update on that per se, because we need to treat each other as competitor until the transaction closes. But that's in a way, James, the only indication I can give you is what we announced when the transaction was announced in September.
Thank you.
One more online.
Thank you. We now have our next question from Nicholas Fuller from Barclays. Please proceed with your question.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my question. Just I had a quick question on the R&D. I know that it's difficult for you to guide towards revenue, specifically on the individual products and business lines, but just thinking about what guidance looks like for 2022, some of the brokers have been explaining that they expect R&D overall to increase. How do you kind of see R&D and also the allocation across the regions as well? So we should expect to see probably MENA and Europe with the greatest allocation to R&D?
Yeah, so R&D is roughly, we don't guide on R&D, by the way, but what we have been delivering through the, since I joined the company at least, is approximately 6% of revenue on R&D. Could be a little bit less, a little bit more, but that's really what has come out over the last few years. I can't guide you on 2022. In terms of where the most money is being spent, when you look at the numbers, we spend a little bit more. We spend more on generics and injectables than we do in MENA. And the simple reason for that is so big portion of our pipeline in MENA is also business development. So we do our own development, but also we compensate or basically mix the two together where we have specialty products in the pipeline, which is done by our partners. So we have delivered around 6% of global revenue, more on generics and injectables versus MENA, but that's really how far I can take you in terms of the allocation of the R&D.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Pete?
Pete, Citi, just two questions, maybe starting with Khalid on cash flow. Pretty strong.
Pretty?
All right, sorry.
Quite
strong. on a serious note, during the crisis, you were making clear that you had higher inventories and that was putting you in good stead. But, of course, there's been profit growth. But is there anything meaningful change in the inventory levels that you're holding, receivables, payables, that is helping? And then secondly, for both of you maybe, on the MENA region, I know there's hyperinflation and effects, but if we put that to one side, anything you want to highlight in terms of country performance? And then more broadly, you've had this long-standing strategy of holding the cost base, delivering a better portfolio. I mean, it feels to me like it was years ago that you did Vraylar, Vitabar 6, the Basilea deal. When might we dream that that starts to sort of translate into a better top-line performance and margins maybe just finally getting off that bottom around 20%?
Mm. You want to add that?
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of cash flow, there was a focus from the beginning of the year, all the management team on how we want to manage inventory levels, because if you look into 2020 versus 2019, it went up. And we had actually a project that we've done with all the segments and involved many of the supply chain, purchasing team, finance, to look into how we are going to optimize our inventory level. And you can see this drove our inventory down and really drive the increase in our operating cash flow. It's one side. It's not just the cash flow, as well receivables. Now we have much more control over our receivables. We put in place certain controls that when countries can sell different levels of authorization and control mechanics to the credit limits, which help as well controlling the receivable balances in a way. So all of these help with the targets that we are setting to the end, to the regions as well, and how they are going to achieve the cash flow targets, help to improve our cash flow. And we've been working on this since some time, not just in this year, and we've been delivering year on year on our cash flow. So it's nothing, I would say, specific other than the inventory, but it's much more control and bringing the inventory into a more normalized level.
Yeah, and also I think on inventory, we are very selective what we keep more inventory of, you know, because of delay in transportation and things like that. There came a shortage of rubber stoppers for our injectable business, and then we sit with more rubber stoppers, you know. So it's not like finance takes everything down. You can see that our inventory 21 is a little bit more than 2019, but lower than 2020. Is that right?
Yeah, 2020 is...
2020 was very high because the pandemic was going on and we let a little bit loose. It was better to have more inventory than less. So there was an opportunity to fix that a little bit in 21. In terms of MENA, the country I call out which did amazingly in 21 but also in 20 was Algeria. Algeria now is our star market in MENA. So well executed on all fronts. They introduced a new oncology plant. We got 8 products from a brand new plant to the market. And the beauty in Algeria is you are alone. If you manufacture locally, then others cannot import it. So I think we grew Algeria 42%, if I remember correctly. So very strong growth. But we also grew in Egypt, you know, not at the same level, and these are tier one markets. In Saudi Arabia is still a very strong market, but what happened in 2021 was that the government restructured the governmental tenders. So there was a delay in the tenders. So the tender part of the business didn't perform maybe as well, but I'm saying that's the timing for me. So there were 6 or 7 different tenders in Saudi Arabia for different parts, different hospitals, different regions. So they now have one central tender for the whole country. And by doing that, there is a delay in the tendering business that's happening. So it will benefit us going forward. But the retail side of the business in Saudi did very, very well. It was encouraging. Jordan did well. Probably the best performance in Jordan that we have seen, at least since I joined the company. So we feel really good about the MENA. In terms of profitability, so if you take out the hyperinflation, they delivered a low 20s as a profitability. The hyperinflation, I'm sure you saw it. It took me forever to I still don't understand why it's done like this, but the hyperinflation obviously increased our revenue but decreased the profitability. So the branded business delivered in constant currency a low 20s profitability, which is where it has been, to your question, Pete. In terms of when we can raise that into the 23-24%, we don't know. But, you know, as you can see, it is no matter how we deliver on the business, it seems to be eaten up by FX and our hyperinflation accounting and things like that. So that's my biggest thing. We launched the Gedeon Richter, the Ryler, in the first country end of last year. It takes a long time to register products in MENA, up to 3 years approval time in many of the markets, especially for specialty drugs they don't recognize. So, we are hopeful. You know, the ultimate goal is we want to be just over 50% branded generics, just under 50% specialty drugs. But also you have to keep in mind is when I introduce specialty drugs, I'm sharing the profit with a partner at the same time. So hopefully there is a better, and the better is more better utilization of my OPEX, better utilization of my sales force, because we have a big sales force. We have 2,000 sales reps and sales support, and I need to grow and better utilize. It's like an overhead in a plant. The more I manufacture, the less the overhead is impacting. It's the same I'm thinking about for the MENA region, but it just takes a little bit. It takes time. Even better. You should see the inventory of rubber stuff that we have. It's beautiful.
Yeah, but the volumes in MENA is as well as increasing. So the business itself is doing very well. As Tiggy mentioned, you get bits and pieces from FX from different countries. So it's like 18 countries. Each country has its own currency. So, but it's in a way we are managing that. And I think this year we are targeting to improve as well.
Maybe the last point on MENA is that, so I think 5, 6, 7 years ago, between 60% and 70% of our sale there was antibiotics. Now, over 50% is chronic medications, and antibiotics is down to 20% to 30% of our sale, which tells you that this strategy of bringing more chronic medication, relying less on the old brands are still good, they're still very valid, but the growth is more in the chronic medication because the movement is less. So I'm really pleased with that. We showed that on the slide, but over 50% of our portfolio being chronic medication is a huge improvement of the portfolio markup that we have for the business. Any more questions online? Nothing. Any more questions in the room? Yeah.
Thank you. Thibault Boutrin, Morgan Stanley. Just two more questions.
Yep.
So the first one, just on the operating margin for the branded business. When we think about the kind of normalized base of low 20s for 2022, will we see some sort of negative base effect in the first half, which means that we'll probably be below this kind of normalized margin because of the hyperinflation dragging on in the first half? So that's my first question. And second question, just on the compounding business, if you could tell us a little bit more about, you know, this is a kind of new industry, so who are the competitors, kind of structure of the market, and just kind of give us a little bit more details on what you're doing here. Thank you.
Do you want to start?
So on the first question, I think if you look into the H1 and H2, in a way, how much we have achieved, there's a lot of, I would say, control calls in the second half in order to manage our, and this is like we put a plan into how to reduce our cost and control our cost, which helped in as well the margins. But a big chunk of the inflationary impact took place at year end because it took us by surprise, to be honest with you, because the currency in Sudan was stabilizing. Suddenly the CPI index showed a different result to the stabilization of the currency. So a big chunk of the FX took place in the second half and therefore affected the margin. If we exclude that, you would see more of a normalized level on margin for the second half, and margin would be stronger than the first half for the branded business.
So in terms of the 503B business, it is a big and growing business. So it's estimated there was a FDA conference, virtual conference last year about this business. It's estimated that the total market is between 2.3 and 4.6 billion. So the reason nobody knows is the direct sale to the hospital. This doesn't hit any wholesalers. So how it happened is basically you have a courier from your plant straight to the hospitals because it's on made for each patient in a way. In terms of the environment, so in the U.S. today, there's 67 companies that say they're into 503B, and they have approximately 75 manufacturing plants for this business. The biggest company is Cuba, Nefron, CAPS, CAPS. Those are the top three, I think, in terms of the business.
Revenue are they generating?
They are not public, so...
Would you guess?
I honestly don't know. I think Cuba... No, I don't know. I think it's in the probably in the hundreds of millions, the biggest ones, you know, maybe hundreds something millions, but it's a pure guess from my point of view. In terms of the portfolio opportunity, it's pretty big, you know. There are different opportunities, and also when there is a shortage in the market, what the FDA allows the compounders to do is to compound this product for the hospitals, you know, if there's a shortage on the listed drug. But the first focus is sterile to sterile compounding, where you take a drug and you make it into a bag when it's not in bag and you mix it. What we heard, and the reason why we stepped into it, is when we met with the hospital pharmacists, the doctors and the nurses, this industry has been inundated with quality issues. And if you go online and go on the FDA website and you look the 483s and warning letter that this industry has had, it's a long reading. This is like all volumes of Harry Potter, you know, that year. So there is a long reading. And they came to us and said, this is not a reliable industry. Is there a way of utilizing the quality system you have for the pharmaceutical companies on the SOPs, the validation, the stability testing, to change this industry into something different and really revamp it in a way that will step up, of course, the quality, but also will give the hospitals more trust in the products that's coming in. So that's really where we came to this. It is that there is a need in this growing market for a high-quality supply. We have a big and beautiful plant. I'm really hoping if this damn pandemic goes away that I could invite you to see the plant. Maybe this year, early next year, because we are ready. It's running. It's estimating we will have 100 people there. In the video that went on social media, you can see a little bit of video from the plant itself, where it is. But the idea behind it, it's a big market. We have to obviously start from zero. We have this idea. We thought about doing an M&A, you know, because it takes a long time to start from zero. But we went against that because what you take is the quality record of the company that you're buying, and instead of starting fresh and taking maybe an extra 1 or 2 years to build up the trust, that was how we thought about it. But the thinking is it's the quality of the pharmaceutical industry we are introducing into the 503D business. Yeah. If you take a microphone.
Yeah, it's just a very quick one, and I expect the answer is no, given the mix of your business. But is there any potential impact, direct or indirect, from Russia-Ukraine conflict?
No. That's a quick answer.
Other than that, on the share price today.
Yeah, it's all Ukraine today.
It's Keyur Parekh from Goldman. A couple of kind of questions for you. One is kind of you've announced a $300 million buyback, which is kind of reflective of this great cash flow you've had last year. But at what level is it also reflective of, in your view, lack of inorganic growth opportunities kind of across the industry? One of the things kind of people want you to do is grow faster. So is this $300 million in buyback kind of because you're not seeing enough growth opportunities, you think you can do 300 plus everything else kind of you want to do? That's question number one. The second is, if press reports are to be believed, kind of there could be a different owner to one of the large generic players by the end of the year. It could be in private equity hands. if that was to happen, how do you think that kind of changes the competitive environment kind of for the broader industry? And what does that mean kind of for Hikma? And then lastly, as you kind of enter this new market on 505B3, how should we think about the margin profile for that business kind of over the next few years? Because you've kind of, as you said, you evaluate it inorganically, entering that market versus doing it organically off a very low base. But I'm presuming it's going to be margin dilutive for you kind of in the next couple of years. But any kind of help there would be helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, so let me start on the last first. So in terms of the margin, so clearly when you're starting and kicking off a business and you hire 100 people to have a very little sale, there will be a little dilution to the margin this year, you know. But overall, when we are up and running and then this business is going and when we have the licenses, we wouldn't expect this to be diluted. It's basically only the startup cost that is impacting the margin. Do you want to take the
In terms of the share buyback, if you look into this year, we've done 2021. We've done several, like Custopharm, and we've done signed two deals on the biosimilar. So we had a couple of, I would say, business and BD activities, and the team's still looking into several opportunities, of course. So a buyback of $300 million is not going to impact us in terms of doing any organic or inorganic growth, because the firepower that we would have is still above a billion or something. Even our net debt today is 0.6 times. The share buyback is going to increase it to a minimum level, and it's not going to affect our ability to do bigger acquisition. So it's just how the management believe that the market is not really seeing the intrinsic value of the business and the value of the business and the multiple that we are trading in.
So Sandoz, so if you look at the profile of Sandoz versus our profile, we really are only overlapping in U.S. They are 55% European company, and then they're all around the world. They don't have a big business in MENA. So the U.S. business, yes, we are competing with them on the injectables and on solid oral in the U.S. I don't think it's changed so much. They have been declining double-digit in the U.S. over the last few years versus where we have been growing double-digit. So they have a very different portfolio of products they are dealing with. They sold their solid oral business. They got it back. So there have been many challenges that they have been facing. So I don't see a new owner of Sandoz will fundamentally affect us. I think it will be a lot of integration that needs to take place, to make this into a standalone company. So I'm not sure it will be operational by year end. But you know, overall, I think the impact on us is very little to nil overall.
You're just following up. So that 505B3, you said when you get to
503B,
you get to that kind of steady state, it won't be margin dilutive.
Yeah.
How long before you get to that steady state?
So I'm hoping that it's so small this year. It's just a tiny bit margin dilutive this year. Next year, I'm hoping that we will already not be dilutive. It might not be accretive next year, but maybe in the third year it could be a tiny bit accretive if the plan goes ahead as we expect. Any last questions? Very good. So I just want to thank you all. Great to see you face-to-face, and thanks to the people on the phone. Hope we can see you all soon face-to-face again. Thank you.